My name is Gary Bornes, and
hi, Gary.
The session this morning is a special interest of mine because it's something I'm searching for, and that's personal empowerment in a nuclear age when we tend to feel very powerless. Most of the ideas of this morning's session will be coming from a book by Joanna Rogers Macy, which I want to recommend to you very highly. The bookstore has it. They had it. I think they have one copy left. There's a copy in the library anyway, if the copy in the bookstore has been sold out. They're ordering it. It's on order. I think that's the correct thing to say. It's called Despair and Personal Power in the Nuclear Age. I chose my title this morning just the personal power part and left out the despair, trying to be upbeat here. But actually, the philosophy of the book, the style of the book, says that it's very important to face our despair and face our fears, our frustrations, our angers, and that the power doesn't come just by wishing for it. It can almost, and she would probably go as far as to say it only comes through a process of facing up to the fear and despair. The big writing on the back cover says, as we allow ourselves to feel our pain for the world, we find our connection with each other. And so many of the themes in a book like this remind me so much of the Christian theme of crucifixion, then resurrection, that somehow, and we don't even quite understand why or how, the crucifixion was necessary for the redemption. There had to be that suffering, that death, that pain, in order to provide, or that has to be the route through which the salvation or the redemption comes. I don't like that. It's not pleasant. It's not cheerful, exactly. A lot of people resist it, especially in this country, where we have upbeat optimism is the thing to have and to be all the time. And the Christian message is one of joy and one of hope, and let's be joyful and hopeful all the time. And yet, in denying the pain and denying the suffering and denying the cross, we've lost something of what our Christianity means. And so Joanna Macy, who's, I'm not sure if she's Christian or not, but she appeals frequently through the book to Christian principles, but she's very eclectic in her appeal. She also appeals to Buddhist principles. She also appeals to Native American principles. She is recognizing in the Christian faith the role that pain and suffering has, or despair, in helping bring us through to a position of greater power and greater motivation. In fact, I guess trying to short-circuit the process too soon, trying to grab onto the resurrection too quickly, is maybe a way of depriving ourselves of the power that comes only through the pain and the suffering. I don't have a lot of pain in my life. I've been in pretty good health. I've had some times of grief. My mother passed away a couple years ago. It was a very difficult time. But I have a good wife, good family. I have plenty to eat. I have the scenery around me here at Holden. I have right now a job, although it's very tenuous. It's renewed year by year, and the state legislature keeps the austerity program it has. It's probably going to last only one more year. And it's only part-time, and so there's some struggle, but there's not a great deal of pain in my life from my own personal circumstances. Sometimes I wonder whether or not I can ever be a very effective Christian, because I'm lacking so much pain. I'm lacking the kind of pain in my life that others seem to experience in such great measure. And so I'm thinking sometimes that maybe I should be going out and seeking a little bit more pain. And sometimes I do wonder, maybe I am called through the privileges of my existence and my education and my nourishment and my family and the love that and the church that I've been part of and given strength through. Perhaps I am called to make greater sacrifices, to involve myself in areas of greater pain and suffering and take on some of that. But on the other side is that sometimes I feel like I'm just barely coping, and our family is just barely coping, that there's an incredible burden of pain that I can hardly name, that has something to do with the situation that we're in collectively. Not my own personal life, but recognition of the pain and the suffering in the world. And that I do indeed feel that inside me. And it does indeed have an effect on my life and how effective I feel I can be sometimes. In talking with other people, you find, or I've found, that when you start talking about what are the problems that are really bothering you, what are the things that seem most burdensome for you in your life, it seems like rather quickly you can dispense with the, or I can, maybe that's my good fortune, but I can dispense rather quickly with the immediate personal problems that I have. Right now I have a cold, and it's kind of annoying. Actually, I'm kind of getting over it, so that's good. But there's those immediate personal things get in our way and cause us a lot of frustration, and we have to deal with them every day. And things at your job aren't always going right, and you're really busy because you've got exams coming up or something, or you've got one thing or another that are kind of on our mind. But as we really start to get at it, we say, "Is that what's really bothering you? Is that what's really?" And then you start pushing a little harder, and you start saying, "No, I guess what's really bothering me is that I'm not exactly happy with the world I'm living in. It's not just my own personal world, it's the whole situation, and I'm grieving for that." Joanna Macy says that grief is healthy. It's a good thing to do. And rather than denying it, rather than pushing it back in our minds and saying, "No, I'm not going to face that, I'm going to just deal with my own problems, I've got enough of my own," we should allow ourselves to feel that grief and live, experience that grief. And coming out of that, she sees a new kind of power, a kind of power that I'm just barely beginning to understand myself, kind of power that I'd like to know more about. And so I'm looking forward to using this book next year in a class at Fairhaven College where I teach. An anthropologist on our faculty actually called it to my attention and said, would I like to join her in doing a course where we would use this book as the text for the course and actually do the exercises in the book. The book is a little like this much theory and principle and this much application in actual practical exercises, workshops, games, rituals that you can go through, brainstorming sessions, almost group therapy type sessions. And she said, "I'd like to not just talk about this in theory, I'd like to actually practice these things in the class and try it out and see what happens." Joanna Macy herself has been doing that for several years, since 1979. I'll read you her biography. She's a teacher of world religions, active in movements for peace and justice. She's the author of a book called Despair Work and Dharma and Development, which is a book about Sarvodaya Village self-help movement in Sri Lanka. Any of you heard of that? There's this exciting thing happening in Sri Lanka, which is a sort of Sri Lanka's the Ceylon, the little island south end of India. And they're basically a third world country that had a lot of development difficulties. Much of the land is owned by tea plantations, and there's a big gap between rich and poor in the country, and they've had health problems, overpopulation problems. And somewhere along the line, and I'm not sure quite what the history of it is, there's been this movement that's been going on there for several years that is sort of a real grassrootsy, let's get together and figure out what our problems are and do something about them. Just an incredible self-awareness, self-help style movement that if you want to know more about it, you can read her book about it. I've not read the book, but I've heard about it from other sources. Several thousand people have participated in Joanna Roger Macy's workshops in the United States, in Europe, and in Asia. She's a mother of three grown children. She's currently living in San Francisco with her husband. So anyway, I'm excited about trying to use some of the techniques of the book in a class situation, and also doing it jointly with an anthropologist, which to me is an exciting marriage between a physicist and an anthropologist trying to talk about peace and empowerment. She's not Christian. She has a very curious, eclectic bag of interests. She works mostly with Native Americans. She teaches a course right now on shamanism. And it's been fascinating to me to find out in the roots of shamanism, so many of the principles common to our Christian faith and common to some of the things I've been talking about the past few days with regard to physics and the discoveries that are being made and the interpretations are being done in the theories of physics, modern physics. Okay. One more thing I want to say. I was really excited about a book like this. I was excited about a book that dealt seriously with pain, because I was one of those folks back in 1979, 1980, when the Aquarian Conspiracy book came out by Marilyn Ferguson. I was really excited by that book, and I felt like, wow, somebody is seeing that something big is going on here. And she, Marilyn Ferguson, has pulled together a number of the threads of this change that's happening, and has been able to point out for people, look, it's not just that there's a peace movement, it's not just that there's an environmental movement, look, it's not just that there's these discoveries going on in physics and biology, it's not just that there's new educational techniques around, it's not just that there's new movements in the churches and in theology, but somehow all these things are kind of tying together and fitting together, and that there's connections and parallels, and you're not alone. If you're working over here, recognize that you have allies over here, over here, over here, over here, and all of you together are bringing about some kind of really exciting change in the world. That's where the term conspiracy comes from. It's not conspiracy in the sense of, let's all get together and plot something. We're not going to tell anybody what it is. It's a conspiracy means literally to breathe together, con spiritus, with the same spirit, with the same breath, breathing together, working together, conspirited, spirited together. It was an exciting title, I thought. But as I read the book, as I mentioned yesterday in my presentation, there were some things about it that kind of turned me off. And part of it was this optimism, this incredible, euphoric almost optimism that comes from the humanist perspective of the sort of California affluence. Marilyn Ferguson herself is a very optimistic person. I mean, you hear her speak and she's just got this incredible, she radiates this, wow, we're going to all get our act together, we're going to do this stuff. And then you read the newspaper the next day and you realize, oh, geez. And so I think some of the people in that movement sort of get these bursts of enthusiasm and optimism and euphoria, and then are let down again the next day because they realize it's just not working, or it's not happening fast enough, or, you know, I can't see it. It's not going the way she said it was supposed to go. And as I read that book, I said, there's several things wrong with this. She hasn't taken into account seriously enough how widespread the suffering and the pain is. She just, I think, has really underestimated the size, the magnitude of the evil. And she hasn't taken evil seriously. It was one of the themes in the Vespers given by Scott last week, that we Americans especially, as Jung pointed out to us, have to take evil more seriously and get to know it, deal with it close up. She didn't deal with pain in the book, hardly at all. The concept of evil, pain, suffering, just were almost ignored. And I said to my wife at that time, I said, oh, I was reading a book at the same time called Light in Our Darkness by Douglas John Hall. Familiar with that? It was a book written actually several years before Ferguson's book, but in some ways it's almost more prophetic and more profound. For me, it is more profound, I guess, because it's set in a Christian context, also recognizing a change of paradigm taking place, a change of worldview or perspective, but acknowledging the suffering, acknowledging the pain, and saying, the subtitle of the book is Toward an Indigenous Theology of the Cross, toward a theology of the cross that's appropriate for our times. And Douglas Hall was saying that something similar to what Joanna Macy's saying is that it's only in really taking the cross seriously, in recognizing that we don't necessarily have victory. Victory doesn't come about because we humans all get together and say, okay, we've got a nice cause here, and we know we're right, we know we're doing the right thing, and by golly, we're going to see it through, and we know that because from the death of the seeming apparent death of the little larva that wraps itself in a cocoon and then bursts forth with the beautiful new life of a butterfly, that's just the way nature is, that because nature is so benign, we therefore have to succeed. And the truth of the matter sort of is that we don't have to succeed. There's no necessary resurrection. Our resurrection for the Christian is a hope. It's not a sure knowledge. Even Paul says something about for hope which is seen is not hope, or something. What is it?
Hope in things that are unseen, is that right? Or we hope in things that
we
are
hope
unseen.
Things that are unseen.
Yeah.
And then he even says stronger that for things that are seen, that's not hope.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
If it were clear, if everybody could see it and believe it, then it's not faith anymore. Then it's sure knowledge, and everybody would agree, oh, good, yeah. I think there's something really special about Christian hope, that it's sort of hope despite the evidence. Despite the fact that we recognize how the best laid plans of mice and men often go awry, despite the fact that we know that, we can still hope. Despite the fact that we know our human fallibilities, despite the fact that we know how pervasive evil is, despite the fact that we feel inside ourselves how impotent we feel and how incompetent we feel and inadequate we feel, despite those things and seeing them very clearly, we dare to hope that God can affect a transformation of the world, even through us. Is that exciting?
A new scientist.
Pardon?
A new scientist.
So this power of pain, or the power of the transformative power that pain and suffering has and can have in our lives, is absent from the Aquarian Conspiracy. It's absent from Fritjof Capra's work. Capra, who I've been idolizing the past couple days, That element is absent in Copper's work. It's absent, obviously, I guess, from Ronald Reagan's work. It's one of the things that scares me about Reaganism and the optimism in the country today, because it seems, or the so-called optimism that Time magazine keeps pointing to, it seems just too ill-founded, too ill-grounded. It hasn't been born out of suffering. It's been just born out of lifting ourselves by our bootstraps. That, you know, okay, America, we can do it. Let's quit all this bad-mouthing that was going on during Carter's era and get on with the task. And it's just this negative thinking. That's what weighs us down. And we've got to get beyond this negative thinking and think positively. And if we think positively, everything will go well. And I guess I still believe that the negative thinking or the pain and the suffering is reality, and we've got to deal with it. We've got to come through that. We can't just ignore it.
Will there be an open discussion later?
Yeah. Why don't you go ahead? You have a comment or question on this?
No, I just...
Okay. I get sort of didactic sometimes and become insensitive to what other people's needs to...
I'd like to make a comment on... I really connected with what you were saying about earlier about how I can get so incredibly flat from my own despair. You know, like, it really doesn't matter, because, you know, the capacity is there to blow ourselves a kingdom come. And if I think about it too much, I begin to realize that we're in a unique time in the history of humankind. Never before have people on Earth had the technological capacity to completely destroy life as we know it. They may have said, this is the war to end all wars, but the tools of destruction were crude by comparison to what we have today. Someone once said, I don't know how World War III will be fought, but World War IV will be fought with sticks and rocks.
Right.
I mean, that just, it hits me and I go, I just deflate like a flat tire. And that's the despair. And I'm not very often able to in an ongoing way, deal with that despair creatively.
And I share that feeling. And I'm not...
I'm fairly optimistic. I mean, that human life is going to survive. I mean, it might be fought with the cell life or whatever it's like.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the optimistic point.
Yeah.
Did the cell life survive?
No, the human life. Sticks and
humans to fight with sticks. And
right.
Maybe, you know, microorganisms or insects. Or mm-hmm.
Well, so you're doing really well.
Yeah, I'm so optimistic, Alan.
I derive a lot of hope from that.
I'm going to read just a little bit of the introduction from Joanna's book, suggest to you, in her words, a little more of the flavor. Despair and empowerment work helps us to increase our awareness of the growing threats, and she names all the threats up above, without feeling overwhelmed by dread, grief, anger, and a sense of powerlessness that they arouse in us. The work overcomes patterns of avoidance and psychic numbing. It builds compassion, community, and commitment to act. The present condition and future prospects of our world engender natural, normal, and widespread feelings of distress. Yet, because of fear of pain and social taboos against expressions of despair and other reasons that we'll examine, these feelings are largely repressed. This repression tends to paralyze. It builds a sense of isolation and powerlessness. Furthermore, it fosters resistance to painful but essential information. It is therefore not sufficient to discuss the present crisis on the informational level alone, or seek to arouse the public to action by delivering ever more terrifying facts and figures. Information by itself can increase resistance, deepening the sense of apathy and powerlessness. Even the that movie, The Day After, shown, and the anti-war people, you know, thought that this might be a good thing. It might help the American folk to wake up and change. And I think it did have that effect for some people. Some people, it was a really galvanizing, emotional, cathartic experience that, that did change their lives. But they conducted a poll afterward and found that Reagan's popularity went up after the movie, that people basically felt more scared of the Russians and were more eager than ever.
We need to be tougher.
To be even tougher, that's right. The only way to prevent that kind of Holocaust is to be even tougher.
Get some more six guns. Yeah. But you know, when I look at history 700-800 years ago, we had the same complex. 3/4 of Europe wiped out of a black plague, and the Crusades weren't going very good. And we were burning witches on every corner at 10, 2, and 4. And people had that same lostness of society is going to it's going to end.
Yeah.
You know, Attila the Hun had done his thing, and now Genghis Khan was doing his thing, and people were really scared. Maybe not with a sense of the place is going to blow up in fragments, and there's, I mean, we might be on a little fragment floating out there somewhere gasping for breath, but people had a fear of their time that they couldn't cope with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we tend to think about
we're the first time only
nuclear cataclysm, but what do we have in Beirut?
That's a good point.
Want to focus on Beirut?
Yeah.
Anybody feel comfortable about Beirut?
I mean, that's not a place that we're
visiting. That's alive and running. That's today. That's now.
The sense that we have now is both the same and different. And on the one hand, any time you're in a situation of war or a situation where your immediate life and surroundings are threatened, even if it's not global, for you that's the end of the world. It is the end of the world. It's the end of everything you know and value. And that can be in Beirut, it can be in Nicaragua or El Salvador, it can be in Afghanistan, it can be in, you know, it can be in just your own personal life. If your spouse dies or something, that can be that same effect.
Last night I caught a little bit of the news from some distant station, wherever it's from. The hostages are still spread around Beirut, over 40, and umpteen Americans were killed in Central America yesterday. And their families must be going through the same pain of saying...
Where in Central America?
I just caught the end of it. But it was like over 20.
In a group?
They said things were sketchy. They didn't have the full reports in, but umpteen American soldiers were killed. Or Marines were killed.
No.
The dress rehearsal of a few years ago is now becoming here.
I'm waiting for you to get to her power. I'm hearing you talk about pain and anger.
I'm going to talk about pain a little longer yet. Can't get through it too
quick.
Gotta
live with it right
for a while. Joanna's workshops, the shortest possible one she tries to do is 2.5 hours.
Where does she do the workshops? Does she go around the country? Or
yeah, what? Yeah, and goes around Europe and goes around Asia, all over, I guess. Typically, she prefers like a day-long or a weekend workshop. We're going to take basically the format of the weekend workshop, spread it over 10 weeks, and do it through a whole quarter, which I'm not sure how that's going to work. I'm kind of anxious about that because of the fact that I'm not sure how long if you can spend 5 weeks doing the down part and sustain that into the 5 weeks of the up part. I'm not sure it shouldn't be condensed into a couple weekends or a weekend at best. But the general format of the workshops is one of going ahead and feeling all the despair you can feel. I mean, if that's what you've been repressing, and she claims that's the case, then letting that be and not hurrying it, not rushing through it, sharing it, and recognizing it's real, and then working out from there.
The mental health number at the bottom of the TV set as you go on.
Pardon?
I have flashed the number of the local mental health unit at the bottom of the
TV. Yeah, I think we. I don't know what we're getting into for sure on this class, but. let's see, where was I? Oh, yeah, we were just talking about the information itself can increase the resistance. In this work, people are drawing resourcefully from general systems theory, from humanistic psychology, and from spiritual teaching by means of structured exercises, body work, guided meditations, rituals, plain talk. They have broken the taboos against expressing their pain for the world and have discovered they can use this pain in ways which affirm their distinctive gifts and common humanity. They have found that by focusing on their felt responses to the present perils, two things happen. Energy is released, for it is with our feelings that our energy lies, and solidarity arises. Discussions and debates on the informational level tend to divide people, especially since argument as to causes and blame and preferred strategies serves as a prime mechanism for the avoidance of painful feelings. But when interactions are on the affective level, on the experiential level, in a setting of safety and support, mutuality arises between people of differing opinions and background. I wanted to give sort of an overview of what Macy tries to do in the, that was a summary, quick summary, the overview of the first several chapters, and read just a few little sections out of the book that indicates the, of things that kind of struck me that I'm looking forward to using the book. First is a joke. What is the difference between ignorance and apathy? Do you know what the difference between ignorance and apathy is? I don't know and I don't care.
What page is that on?
I don't know and I don't care. She starts out with a section dealing with planetary perils and the psychic responses, and she says that's a good place to start very often with the group would be to stew brainstorming on what do you see as the perils to the planet beyond your personal threats to your person, what are the threats to the species? And of course you can do that in a session with brainstorming, you can read her answers. The standard answers that she, of course, pays attention to are the ones that have been on my mind and bother me, one being the big nuclear threat, one being ecological threat, and the third being the, basically, I don't know what to call it, but the injustice threat. Just the mere fact that there are, right now, people who, for their, in their world, they're like, their world is ending. I mean, their children are dying, they personally are starving, their world has come to an end. And basically, the gap between rich and poor is growing, and the number of people in that bottom half of the world, for them, their lives are getting worse. Joanna talks about personal pain for your personal death, but then that feeling of a different kind of pain from species death. She talks about compassion, goes to the roots of those words, that word, compassion, come with, passion, feeling, a feeling with, or a pain with. It's a pain with others. It's not just a pain for yourself, it's a pain with, in connection with other people. What are the reactions to experiencing this compassion or this concern? And she says very often the reactions can be, the reactions to those nuclear threats or those large global threats. She says the reactions rather than compassion might be apathy. Apathy literally means that the same pathos, passion, as in passion, is in there. Apathy means lack of feeling. Non-feeling, non-suffering. It can be disbelief, it can be denial, it can be leading what she calls a double life, just basically making yourself sort of schizophrenic and having this on one side but then doing your life busily and actively on the other side. What are some of the causes of this repression? I mean, there's long sections on each one of these topics. I'm just doing a real superficial skimming of the approach that she takes, partly to give you an indication of whether you're interested in buying the book and using it in your own church or your own life. She says it can be used, I think it can be effective both as a personal thing to go through or as a thing that you would want to perhaps do with a group in a church. It would be very effective. Some of the causes of this repression are fear of pain, fear of appearing morbid, fear of appearing stupid, fear of guilt, fear of causing distress. That was your point of I have fears of doing this course next year because I'm not sure I have to somehow trust that there will be the resources available in me or in other people or in God to deal with any distress that is evoked. And I'm somewhat allowing for that possibility on the basis of Joanna Macy's experiences, where she indicates that out of the community of people experiencing the evocation of those fears, there is a supportive, nurturing, upholding sense that arises.
English
101. Oh, well, we have 2-hour classes instead of 1-hour classes, so that makes it a little bit better. There's techniques, we'll get into that later. Fear of provoking disaster. I want to read a little section on the fear of provoking disaster. There is a superstition that negative thoughts are self-fulfilling. To speak of doom will make it more likely to happen. But in fact, it is just the opposite. Psychoanalytic theory and personal life experience shows us that it is precisely when we repress what we repress that eludes our conscious control and tends to erupt into behavior, undesired behavior. Carl Jung says, when an inner situation is not made conscious, it happens externally as fate. Unfortunately, many of us, ignorant of this fact, make the one who expresses alarm over the prospects of nuclear war somehow feel guilty of somehow contributing to the very fate that we fear.
That's what Ronald Reagan's doing.
Yeah, I think so.
Absolutely.
Let's not talk about it, because if we talk about it, then it might come about. And the opposite side of that, though, I think is true, and she's going to talk about that later. That if you do positive visioning, that process itself is empowering. That somehow, if you dwell on negative visions, and that's where you stop, then maybe you can find some self-fulfilling prophecies going on there in your own life. Or I mean, if you spend all your time worrying about what's going to happen, what's going to go wrong, you'll find a lot of things happening going wrong. But if you recognize that as a prelude, as the first step of something you have to get through and pass through, and then spend time on the positive visioning, I think those positive visions can be empowering for you. There's a fear of appearing unpatriotic. She has several paragraphs about a fear of sowing panic, fear of religious doubt. God won't let this happen, and if you start thinking about it happening, and that starts giving you doubts about your own faith and God, and who is this God that might let this happen, and how could God have let us get this far, and all that, those kinds of issues come up for some people. And so, rather than face that doubt, you might just want to repress it and not think about it. A fear of appearing too emotional, I'm going to read several sections on that. I hope that time did that too well. But I'll do it anyway. For centuries, the dominant Western white male culture has erected a dichotomy between reason and emotion. Assuming that reality can be apprehended in an objective fashion, it has accorded higher value and trust to the analytical operations of intellect than to the subjective realm of feelings and sensations and intuitions. Such dichotomies are no longer found to be valid. For advances in subatomic physics that I've been talking about the past couple days, depth psychology and general systems theory reveal the fallacy of this objectivity. But old mental habits die slowly. Many of us, schooled in the separation of reason and feeling, want to discount and discredit our deepest responses to the conditions of the world. Dread of nuclear holocaust, grief for expiring species, horror for the millions in hunger, oh, these are just feelings, frequently dismissed in ourselves and in others as self-indulgent, idealistic, or irresponsible. Given the different ways that the sexes are socialized in our culture, men suffer more than women from the fear of appearing too emotional. Displays of feeling can cause them to be considered unstable, especially in work situations. Yet women experience this fear too. They often withhold their expressions of concern and anguish for the world, lest these be treated condescendingly as just like a woman. You women always overreact to these kinds of things. Just handle it rationally. Alice Cook, a British journalist, has said, lack of emotionalism in discussions about nuclear war is not a sign of reason, but of sick passivity. Something else is going to be so we'll... And then finally, the fear of feeling powerless. And I think that's, for me, that's one of the strongest ones. And when I talk to students, it's one of the strongest ones. They say, why talk about nuclear war? Why talk about eco-disaster? Because it just makes me sick, because there's nothing I can do about it anyway. So why talk about it? If there's nothing you can do about something, you're just going to get yourself frustrated by learning about it and realizing how powerless you are. And so I think there's some truth in that. We've had the liberals of the country that tend to want to raise people's consciousnesses, and I'm guilty of it too, trying to say, look, there's a problem out there, everybody pay attention, there's a problem, without providing any resource for what you can do about those kinds of problems. And that's why I'm excited about Joanna Macy's approach, because she's saying very specifically that that's the awareness of the problem is only the first part. It's living through that, that then some power might come. You may have to come tomorrow if you can try and find out about the power that comes, because that's going to get to the second half.
Is there any time we could continue something like this? Because this is a really, you can't cover a topic like this in an hour.
Sure. Well, there's two sessions, both on the same topic, on the same book, today at 10:45 and tomorrow at 10:45.
Great. Is this a continuation or are you going to start over?
Yes, no. Tomorrow's session is a continuation of this one. Well, that gives you hope. Look, if we're already into despair, look at all that good stuff.
I'm still despairing.
Well, it makes sense of it, though. This is really helpful, I think.
I think there's something from primitive religions that are it's very helpful, because they raise the demons and face them. And then once you look the demon in the face, you can deal with it. And I think, when we try to repress our fears about ecological disaster or nuclear war, we won't look at our demons, and then they become even more scary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Aaron,
yeah.
Some of your students who say that, maybe you should get the film or the video made almost 50 years ago, 40 years ago, on Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Hmm.
To Jimmy Stewart's story of the young guy who's a Boy Scout leader that gets forced to take someone who died in Congress's place. They think he'll be a puppet. And he finds out that the corrupt politicians want to take some land away that's Boy Scout land and whatever else and buy it for themselves. And he makes this great big standoff, as if you'll recall the film, where he's going to talk and talk, and he starts reading the Bible from beginning to end until enough letters come in to change the whole decision. And he wins.
Wow.
Here's this old movie, almost 50 years old, to say the little guy for ecology, and it wasn't called ecology in those days, can win out. And how can you rally around a Mr. Smith who goes to Washington to fill in as a puppet? Mm-hmm. The movie was 50 years ahead of its time.
Keep that in mind.
Well, when you're reading about how we've raised up these issues, and it's been like burning concerns, and they're still there. I mean, I have a real eye experience with that. When I was 20 years old, I was a real I was a real firebrand. You know, I saw hunger. You know, we got to do something about it. And I, you know, stand up and I fight with anybody who didn't, you know, think that we should do something about hunger. And I did marching and raised money and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And now I'm older and I feel so guilty. I can't even stand to look at the TV presentations of Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
It's like I don't even want it. I know it's there. I know it's always been there. When I was 19, I would eat it up. I couldn't get enough of it, you know, because knowledge was power. And now it seems like knowledge is truth, and truth is reality, and reality is bad, and reality is terrible, you know. And I go, it's just, yeah, and then I'm overwhelmed with guilt. And you know, guilt is a cousin with despair.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
It's heavy.
That's right. And I think there's a number of us that have already been through the anguish and the guilt and the recognition of what the thing is and the suffering and stuff. And so I think you're right to say, Dad, Kevin, I've been doing this for 10 years, 20 years, and I'm ready for some power. I'm ready for some breakthrough out of that. I don't want to have to spend a lot of time in more anguish, because I've felt the anguish. I've lived with it. And so I think her method, and I think in our teaching of it, we're going to need to respect that and be able to help people move through that more quickly that have already experienced that. She's talking about a lot of people, and you know them, that have just never dealt with the feelings, never acknowledged that they have those feelings, have shut off the information at a very early point, rather than at your, you know, whereas you absorbed it and said, I want to know about these things, and now are oppressed by them. There's been other people that have, for the sake of maintaining their own psyche defenses, have blocked them off at a very early point and just said, this is something I'm not going to be able to deal with, and so I'm not going to pay any attention to it, and so then block it off. Whereas what Joanna's saying is that we do have resources for dealing with this kind of stuff. And those resources are especially not just individualistic, although I think it would be good to use a movie like that, but they're collective. And that's the point I want to emphasize, and that's the point that she emphasizes too, that it's almost only through recognizing corporate power, through recognizing synergy, that we can realize that there's more there than we ourselves can ever possibly rally. That there's limits to what I can do personally, but corporately there's all kinds of strange things that happen when people get together and work together.
In the program over here, I don't know if anyone has had a chance to see it, there's a slide presentation called For Life. It's mm-hmm. on Friday evenings. It's put out by Sojourners group out of Washington. And I think it's a real excellent thing to see on the nuclear arms issue, because it not only portrays the despair, but also portrays a hopeful alternative, mm-hmm. showing the collective strength of people that come together under, you know, a problem and have a wonderful outcome instead of the day after type thing where everything is destruction and death. And I would really recommend it.
I saw it last week when I first came to the village, and I agree with you completely. It's really, it's powerful, it's heavy, and yet it's uplifting. It's it makes you feel like It strengthened my faith. It reminded me that it wasn't just up to me. and it's not just up to me or us, but that God is still alive and well and with us, working with us.
Is it on each Friday, you think?
Mm-hmm. I think it's like at the... I'm not sure what the schedule is now, 6:30 or 7 o'clock.
Is it Friday or Saturday? Is it Friday nights or Saturday nights?
Saturday.
Okay.
Saturday.
But is it available through the Sojourners group?
I probably think it would be.
You could probably write or call them and ask them. I'm sure they're willing to make some money off of it and sell some mm-hmm. more.
I
The negative effects of repressing feelings can be, I'll just name them real quick, psychic, she has, again, paragraphs or pages on each one of these, psychic numbing, fragmentation, alienation, frantic activity, manic denial, political passivity, destructive behavior, psychological projection, or seeking scapegoats, resistance to painful information, diminished intellectual performance, burnout, sense of powerlessness. It's just, you can see all these things. I mean, I can see them myself, I can see them in other people, I can see them in the country. So, the theoretical foundations that she establishes, she says there are five principles of this kind of process. The first is to recognize that feelings of pain for our world are normal and healthy. And that this pain is not morbid. It's morbid only if it's denied. If you deny it, it sets inside and sort of festers and ferments and gets sick and morbid. If you confront it, if you discuss it, if you talk about it, if you let it be open, that's a healthy thing for your body, for your mind, for your spirit. Information alone is not enough. That's her third principle. Fourth principle, unblocking of repressed feelings releases energy, clears the mind, and unblocking our pain for the world reconnects us to the larger web of life. And I want to read a little section on that and then summarize here. When the repressed material that we unblock is distress for our world, catharsis occurs, but also something more than catharsis. That is because this distress reflects concerns that extend beyond our separate selves, beyond our individual needs and wants. It is a testimony to our interconnectedness. Therefore, as we let ourselves experience and move through this pain, we move through to its source, we reach the underlying matrix of our lives. What occurs then is beyond catharsis. The distinction here is an important one. To present despair and empowerment work as just one of catharsis would suggest that after owning and sharing our responses to mass suffering and to the prospects of mass annihilation, we could walk away purged of pain for our world. But that is neither possible nor adequate to our needs, since each day's news brings fresh cause for grief. By recognizing our capacity to suffer with our world, we dawn to wider dimensions of being. In those dimensions, there is pain still, but there is a lot more. There is wonder, even joy, as we come home to our mutual belonging, and there is a new kind of power. That's her lead-in to a whole section on the web of life, which is the kinds of things I've been talking about the past couple days. I'm going to read one statement that I had forgotten was in this book, by Albert Einstein. You'd never guess it was Albert Einstein saying this. I mean, I should have read it first and let you try to guess who it was. But a human being is a part of the whole a human being is a part of the whole, called by us universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts, and feelings as something separated from the rest. Kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty.
Another quote by Einstein that's really important is that he says, imagination is more important than knowledge.
Okay, the next section, which I didn't get to today, but I want to talk about tomorrow, is called Power as Process. Power as Process is a re-understanding, a reinterpretation of our usual thoughts about power. Power meaning not power over, not meaning that we can get more power than the commies or more power than the militarists and finally win the war with them, but a power over the enemy, but power with, in conjunction with, even with the enemy, shared, building a new kind of world or reality in conjunction with the enemy. Sort of the kind of thing that the peace train folks did when they finally got the peace train, no, the white train, the nuclear bomb train. They finally got that thing stopped. It's a symbol, it's a symbolic thing, but it could only be done not by their own power, but it had to be done cooperatively with a joint venture with the Burlington Northern people, with local deputies and sheriffs, with the and then with the peace activists or protesters. And it had to be a cooperative thing to actually get it accomplished. Now, the question is going to be permanently stopped.
Well, in other words, for a few brief moments, you know, the war machine was stopped on those tracks.
Right.
The power was essentially equalized at that point.
And we have to look and celebrate those moments and see those as signs that can, signs of promise, signs of hope. So I want to talk tomorrow more about power as process and about opening to power. And let me read one nice summary.
That's not in the bookstore yet, is it?
The book?
Yeah.
It was, but I think the last copy has been sold. The last time I looked for it, it wasn't there. Where is it? Despair and empowerment work, therefore, is consciousness raising in the truest sense of the term. It increases our awareness, not only of the perils we face, but also of the promise inherent in the human heart. Whether we make it or not, whether our efforts to heal our world succeed or fail, we live then in so vivid a consciousness of our community that the most obvious and accurate word for it is love. And that seems, in and of itself, a fulfillment. I guess I have to elaborate on that. It would be a nice closing statement. What she's saying is that even if we failed, the process that we've gone through has been the richest way we could live in these times. Because we've recognized our connectedness, our dependence on God. This strange times in which we live is a powerful force for helping our faith to grow, helping our love for one another to grow, for building Christian community, for building community. And so we should rejoice in that and recognize that as a worthwhile thing, no matter what the end is.